If you're traveling this holiday weekend, we've run out of overhead space, and be sure your cooler is filled with patience. It's gonna be busy. Memorial Day travel is expected to be up in Arizona and all across the country.
Consumers feel a little bit better off than they did, you know, a couple of years ago. And so that, I think, then compels them to go out and to go travel.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, another surprise in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's contempt of court saga, what it takes to protect the country's last primitive area.
What students learn about themselves in high school.
And watch out.
I'm getting better at it with pride. There's another one.
Everyone okay?
Well, we survived.
Plus, getting desert kids into hockey, and we ride the elevator to the top.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Checking Valley traffic at this hour. Not much going on. There is a disabled vehicle, I-17 northbound at Happy Valley. But you can expect a little bit later this afternoon some heavy traffic as people get out for the long weekend. And Valley weather for that long weekend, it'll be mostly sunny tomorrow with a high near 83. Look for a high of 84 on Sunday, then back into the upper 80s on Monday. Currently with relative humidity at 23%, mostly sunny and 80 degrees at KJZZ.
Another surprise came in the contempt case against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio today. Just minutes before the judge was set to begin a status conference with the parties, lawyers for the sheriff filed a motion for the judge to step down from the case. Joining me now is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Hi, Jude.
Hi, Mark.
So this is obviously a pretty big development.
Right. Judge Murray Snow has been on this case since 2009 and ruled against the sheriff in the racial profiling case in 2013. Snow initiated contempt proceedings against the sheriff for violating his orders. Those proceedings began in April. The contempt hearings were supposed to resume on June 16th, but at the moment, Snow can't take any more action in the case until this motion is resolved. It's also worth noting Snow is the second judge in this case because the first one recused herself after the sheriff requested it.
So why is the sheriff arguing that Judge Snow has to be taken off this case?
They're citing statutes that say a judge must recuse himself if there is an appearance of impartiality or if there is an actual conflict of interest. They say both are relevant. A big part of this relates back to Judge Snow's direct questioning of Arpaio last month in the contempt hearing. That's when he asked the sheriff about a Phoenix New Times article and whether it was true that the sheriff had investigated Judge Snow or his family.
And that's how we ultimately learned a woman named Karen Grissom had contacted the sheriff via Facebook and said she had heard the judge's wife say the judge wanted to get Arpaio out of office.
Right. And we learned the sheriff's lawyer hired a private investigator to follow up on those comments. The sheriff also revealed in that questioning he had hired a confidential informant in Seattle to do another investigation. The judge then asked for documents to be turned over in both of those investigations. Last week, Snow said after reviewing documents, he believes the Seattle informant may have been hired to prove a bogus conspiracy between Snow and the Department of Justice meant to discredit the judge. Now, getting back to this motion to recuse, Arpaio is arguing Snow has to go because he now has an interest in the outcome of the case because his own reputation is at stake. And also, once the judge began looking into this whole issue about the sheriff investigating his wife's comments, it made the judge's wife a material witness in the case, another conflict.
What are the plaintiffs saying about this?
Well, keep in mind, Judge Snow has sided with the plaintiffs throughout most of this case. When I spoke to ACLU's Cecilia Wong outside of court, she hadn't even had a chance to read the motion yet because it had been filed just minutes before the court session began. But she disagrees with the judge being taken off this case. Let's take a listen.
Frankly, the timing of Arpaio's motion is very suspect and indicates that this is an effort to manipulate the judicial system and to derail the contempt proceeding, which is currently underway and was scheduled to continue on June 16th.
I should say the sheriff's lawyers disagree that this is a stalling tactic.
So is the June continuation of the contempt hearing in jeopardy now?
I think it very most likely is. The judge is giving the parties some time to weigh in on this question. Then he'll decide if he will recuse himself or not. There could also be appeals potentially. But a lot needs to happen before the June hearing, and that can't happen as long as we don't know who the judge is in this case.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
This weekend marks the unofficial start of summer, and AAA Arizona predicts 733 Arizonans will travel over the Memorial Day holiday. That'd be an almost 5% increase over last year. For more on holiday travel, we turn to Jan Freitag, Senior Vice President with STR, which, among other things, provides research to the hotel industry.
We have seen unprecedented numbers of rooms sold over the last couple of years after 2009. We expect that room demand is going to grow again this year, actually, and again next year. And so we expect very healthy room demand for the upcoming travel season, specifically starting this weekend. With that then comes pricing power for hoteliers, so we expect that room rates are also increasing at a pretty healthy clip.
AAA says that there will be about 5% more Arizonans traveling this Memorial Day than last. Are there specific factors to which you can attribute that?
Well, I think it has to do with a couple of things. It's more psychological than anything. So the stock market is doing very, very well. Unemployment is, if not dropping, at least it's staying basically the same. You know, and I think consumers feel a little bit better off than they did, you know, a couple of years ago. And so that, I think, then compels them to go out and to go travel.
Do you find that folks who are going to be traveling this holiday weekend are driving to where they're going? Are they flying to where they're going?
That is a very much it depends answer, depending on the market where they're going to. So I would think that Arizonians, you know, are certainly surrounded by a bunch of beautiful and easily accessible drive-to areas. So I would think that plays a lot to it. Getting into Phoenix is normally a fly-to destination from a lot of different markets. So I would think that you're seeing a lot of, if the tourists are coming to Phoenix, they probably fly there. But I think people who live in Phoenix, for example, are probably driving.
How much does the travel industry look at this weekend when trying to figure out how the rest of the summer is going to go?
So you have to keep in mind that this is a leisure weekend. And for the U.S. hotel industry and for the travel industry overall, generally Monday through Thursday are business days. So we have to look at this weekend as an indicator maybe for the health of the leisure industry, not so much for a health indicator for the health of the total industry, just because the business travel and the group travel we know is strong and will be strong.
Jan Freitag is a senior VP with STR. Jan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Arizona's rental housing market does not have a ton of good options for low-income renters. That's according to a new report from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, which ranks Arizona 22nd in the country as far as affordability of a two-bedroom apartment. For more on what the report says and what it means, we turn to Val Iverson, Executive Director of the Arizona Housing Alliance.
I think the report clearly showed that it's still difficult to find an affordable apartment in Arizona. The report showed that a typical worker needs to earn at least $16.87 an hour to be able to afford a typical apartment in this state, and that's far and above what our workers are making in this state.
So why is it, do you think, that it is so hard for folks to be able to find one that they can afford?
Well, I think it's a shortcoming in the market. Developers do a great job of building lots of apartments in Arizona, but unfortunately, they're not building the apartments that match the income levels of those in the state. So a recent study by the National Low Income Housing Coalition actually found that we have a shortage of 140,000 affordable apartments for those low-wage earners. And Arizona is unfortunately the third worst state in the country in addressing the housing needs of our most vulnerable populations.
You hear from developers, though, all the time who say, you know, we're not going to build something that nobody's going to live in. So if they're building higher-end apartments, clearly there are people who can afford to live in them. What, I guess, would be the draw for a developer to build maybe a complex or an apartment building for lower-income folks?
Well, that's the catch, because developers are not going to build apartments at this level on their own. But Arizona provides incentives to all types of businesses. So Arizona needs to provide some public investment to entice the private market so that it can work for all Arizonans. In fact, Arizona has a state housing trust fund, and we've been working to restore funding to the state housing trust fund to provide those type of incentives so that the apartments will be built that match the income levels of those in this state.
If you drive around the valley, it's pretty obvious that there's a lot of apartment building going on. You see buildings and complexes going up all over the place. When new apartment complexes come online, even if they're higher end, does that push the slightly older ones who might also be somewhat high end down the scale and make those perhaps more affordable than they were before the newer buildings were built?
Well, that's exactly the choices that low-wage workers are having to make. Low-wage earners have to make difficult choices every day. Either they find an affordable apartment that's in a less desirable neighborhood and in poor condition, or they find a decent apartment in a safe neighborhood, but they pay too much for rent.
So what's the answer then? I mean, you mentioned the housing trust fund. I mean, how do we fix this?
Well, really, it takes some resources to provide incentives to the developers. In this state, we like to provide carrots instead of sticks. So we have a state housing trust fund that was receiving, prior to the recession, over $30 million a year. And that was doing a great job of making sure that we were building apartments for all income levels in the states and meeting all of Arizona's needs. During the recession, that state housing trust fund was capped at $2.5 million, and that is never going to help to meet the need of 140,000 apartments for our most vulnerable families.
So how much money do you think it would take to be able to build or fix up apartment buildings so that all of those folks could have a place to live that they could afford?
If we were able to restore our housing trust fund to its previous levels, in a few decades, we could probably meet the needs of all Arizonans and make sure that they all had an affordable and available apartment to live in. But it's going to take a few years to make up for the deficit that we've created in this state.
Val Iverson is Executive Director of the Arizona Housing Alliance. Val, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Coming up, a Valley High School teacher talks about what she learned about her graduating class of seniors.
They're really neat and capable people, and we forget because of their age range that, well, what do they know? They're so young. But they've witnessed a lot in their young lives.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. He's Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic, 202 eastbound, the Red Mountain Freeway. An accident has some right lanes blocked at Alma School. Look for partly sunny skies across the valley for the rest of the afternoon. A little cooler with a high of 83 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, overnight lows in the lower 60s. Partly to mostly sunny tomorrow and Sunday with highs in the mid to upper 80s into the lower 90s on Memorial Day on Monday. Right now, it's 80 degrees at KJZZ at 216.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership featuring the 2015 Forester with 32 mpg and enhanced safety features for anything life throws at you. Online at shopsubaru.com.
Remember, whatever role you fall into in high school, you are stuck with it for the rest of your life. You've got the jocks, the bullies, the pretty girls, the smart girls, the burnouts.
The sportos, the motorheads, geeks, bloods, wastoids, dweebies.
High school can be tough. All the labels, all the fitting in. I think it's safe to say that Steve and I didn't do much of either of those things. At Combs High School in Santan Valley, which held its graduation last night, English and creative writing teacher Jess Burnquist surveys graduating seniors about what they learned. The responses range from practical, like don't procrastinate, to correcting misconceptions like no one ever bursts into song in the cafeteria. Jess, you've been doing this survey for years now, so why did you start?
What drew me to it was the notion that they're going through a rite of passage. The entire year is really like a rite of passage for these kids. They're getting ready to launch their lives, whether that means school or work, or taking a break and trying to figure out who they are. And I think it's so important to give them the space and the time to reflect on those things. And the project speaks to that.
Do you find yourself surprised by the answers?
You know, I'm not ever that surprised. I think what is surprising, to be honest, is their reaction to their own answers, because there are lots of jokes about procrastinating on the project, but there's still a level of depth and integrity. And I don't know, when they spend time really thinking about who they are, it's really hard just to give a sloppy, quick answer because it has to do with them. So the only thing that really surprises me is their authenticity and how much it shines.
Does that include areas in which they're not sure, like maybe they don't know what they want to do or they don't know what's next?
Yeah, and I think a lot of times the kids who may be perceived as being on track, they know exactly what's next, they make the discovery that they're not so sure after all. Maybe they have a different opinion about their futures than their parents or their teachers, for that matter, about what they should do with their lives. And so it's always really exciting to witness the beginning of that discovery, because how can one be happy if they're not being true to themselves?
When you go through the answers and read them, are there certain themes that sort of manifest themselves? I mean, are there certain areas in which a lot of students tend to discuss?
Well, that's a good question. Definitely a theme of anxiety. But it's also, it's really poignant. I mean, a lot of these kids are going to be away from their families for the very first time in their lives. And they're excited about that, but also a little bit terrified, and that makes sense. Another theme is joy. Another theme is regret, because they're asked to really think about their high school experience. And sometimes they have to confront the notion that they weren't true to who they were while they were in high school, or they let fear or insecurity prevent them from doing things, or their egos got in their own way. And they did so much that they forgot to just be present in what they were doing, and they forgot to enjoy it.
What kinds of things do the students tend to be anxious or scared or nervous about?
I think they're often really scared about money these days. That was a theme this year especially. In the past, their anxiety has had to do with developing meaningful relationships or pursuing a life that reflected who they were at their core, as opposed to pursuing a paycheck. It makes sense that they would want to do well financially, but at times that can almost be in direct conflict, they think at least, with their passions.
Based on the responses that you read from your students, do you get the sense that they are emotionally and otherwise ready for college or a career or whatever they're going to do after high school?
I do. And I think that it shines through. Here's the thing. I can give them as many basic skills that they're willing to learn. And they have issues in their lives that sometimes distract them from learning things like comma placement. At the same time, they're really neat and capable people. And we forget, you know, because of their age range that, well, what do they know? They're so young. But they've witnessed a lot in their young lives, and they're conscious of it. And it shows up not just in these senior projects, but in our daily interactions. I really do have confidence in these kids.
One of Jess's students is Maddie Witt. Maddie, congratulations. You just graduated.
Oh, thank you.
So what did you learn, do you think, by doing this project?
I think I learned a lot more about myself, who I am and who I want to become. I think it really gives you a chance to look into who you want to be versus who you think you're going to be versus who you were.
Were you surprised by your own answers?
Some of them, yes, and then some of them, no. I won't lie. There's certain things I'm definitely at this point at 18 confident about and who I am. But then there's other things you start to question, like she was saying, you honestly do. And I think that's where the learning happens of yourself, and I think that's the importance of it.
What were you certain about, and what surprised you?
I definitely was certain about maybe things more I'm afraid to do in the sense of who I want to be versus who I think I'll become.
And how about what surprised you?
I would say my goals, the things that I wanted to do that I wasn't aware that I wanted to do. There's other things, though, that just surprised me aspiring-wise, that I wanted to be like the president of the United States, and I'm not kidding when I say that. I want to do that. Like, I don't see why I couldn't, and I'm not afraid of things like that. And when you're writing them down on a project, you're like, no, I'm serious about this. I mean, that could be a real possibility one day. That's something I want to do.
So now that you've graduated, what's next?
I'm going to be going to Arizona State University. Don't ask me about my major because I'm not sure. And I think that's another thing from the project I learned, is that it's okay to not always have an answer. I just know I want to pursue an education, get a degree, and I want to do something that makes me happy in life, and I'm hoping I'll figure that out within the next 4 years.
18-year-old Maddie Witt just graduated from Combs High School in Santan Valley. Jess Bernquist teaches English and creative writing there.
If you happen to wake up in the middle of the night, make sure you're wearing shoes. And it might be smart to have a flashlight handy because it's scorpion season in the valley. Scorpions can be deadly to young and old, and for those of us in the middle, a scorpion sting hits sharply and then lingers as your hand or arm or foot, whatever was stung, goes numb. Dawn Gouge works on urban entomology for the University of Arizona. She says rather than spraying poison around your house to keep the scorpions out, you may want to fill in some cracks.
Of a night, they will wander around. They're looking for food themselves. They're looking for each other. And that is when they're more inclined to move into a structure. And generally, they get inside your home the same way you and I do, right through the front door. It's not always because those doors are propped open, but those external doorways, quite often the weather stripping or the door sweeps at the bottom of the door are not a tight fit. And if you can shove a penny or a quarter underneath your door, that means a box scorpion can scoot under there and squeeze through.
So it's nighttime. It's about 8:30. And it's dark. All the lights are off. A lot of stars in the sky. This should be a good night to hunt for scorpions. We went out about a week ago, right after we'd had a little rain. The weather was cooler. Did not even see one. But then there was one night we saw about a dozen. On the wall, on the ground, in the bushes, everywhere, because they glow in the dark. As if scorpions aren't strange-looking enough, when you shine the black light on them, they glow like a neon green. So my wife and I are walking close by the house now to see if there are any up on the walls that could sneak in. Okay, what's your reaction when you actually see one?
My toes curl.
I wish my toes had curled before I actually got stung by one. It would have warmed me a little bit, but numb arm for about 12 hours. Did not feel good.
There's one right there, right in the middle of the cool deck. Look. Looks bright green.
It's just sitting there like nothing.
Perfect target.
So now we're going to see if we can kill this thing with not the best tool of a trade, a fly swatter.
That was painless. Quick and painless. But now I have to clean up. I actually dented the fly swatter handle. I'm getting better at it with practice. There's another one. Oh! Oh my gosh, where is it? Oh, here it is. I thought that one flew right up on you. Did you hear my squeal? I don't have a killer instinct. They're just potentially dangerous. If they hadn't come inside the house, I'd leave them alone.
When our quest had finished, we'd found and killed 8 scorpions. Then after putting the tools away, another emerged on the front door. We got that one too, to keep it from getting inside my elderly mother-in-law's house. After a night of staring at neon green stingers and sending scorpions back into the dirt, I visited Kelly Walterscheid in Mesa. He's the man behind Scorpion Hunter. But that part of the business started by accident. He works with LEDs, which he discovered can help spot scorpions in the dark from many feet away.
Being that my business is next door to a public facility that hosts weddings and has lots of food, lots of crickets that show up, we had some experimentation time. So we took tweezers and learned that could grasp this little critter, but what do you do with this thing? Okay, well, we could kill it. We could, you know, we could put it in poison. We could heat it up with a torch like guys like to do, or we could just stomp on it. Okay, that wasn't solving the problem. We noticed that the scorpions or the baby scorpions, first of all, don't glow, and they are on mama's back. So you may feel good that a poison trail was laid down by your pest control guy. And the scorpion may happen upon that trail and kill itself. Mm-hmm. But guess what? The the little scorpions that are on its back, mama's back, are just going to crawl away and be happy to start a whole new family, okay?
But Walter Scheid sees himself as a hunter-gatherer rather than a hunter-killer. He has a kit that includes an 8-inch-long tweezer, a special frequency black light, and goggles.
The process is simple. You collect your scorpions probably 3 times in a row in the middle of the night when temperatures are above 60 for the lows. So when the monsoon starts hitting and the food starts increasing as far as crickets and all that good stuff, you're going to see the maximum scorpion and, you know, habitats happening. And so 3 nights in a row, probably 2 a.m. in the morning when you're in your deepest night of sleep, the scorpions are most active. So sorry, but you're going to have to get up 3 nights in a row. And they don't all feed every night. So that's the idea. So in 3 nights in a row, you're going to get 90% of your population. And once you've cleared your property, you're good to go. Now, you could have a neighbor full of scorpions. You're going to have to work that out. But they're not going to be like a swarming bee where once you remove one set of scorpions or maybe dozens on your property, you're going to have a whole new set come in the next day. They move very slow.
Walter Scheid places a container with the scorpions in bright sunlight for about 10 minutes, which kills them. If you're feeling especially humane, he says you can take the container, unseal it, and release the scorpions into the desert, preferably far away from your own neighborhood. Of course, then you'll have to find some other way to entertain yourself at night.
A few years ago, KJZZ brought you a story about a program giving people who were visually impaired the opportunity to hike and raft in the Grand Canyon. It's part of a larger program led by Eric Weinmeier, the only blind man to summit Mount Everest.
I think there's such a blurry line between the things that we cannot do and the things that we can. And the most exciting aspects of our lives is when we're able to become a pioneer and blast through those lines.
Today we follow a local group training to do the same thing here in Phoenix, and as KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, they're working for more than just bragging rights.
They meet every Wednesday and one Saturday a month. This week, the group has organized at North Mountain, preparing for a 5-mile trip up the Shaw Butte Trail.
We're ready.
These trips are organized by the Foundation for Blind Children in Phoenix. The 4 kids on today's hike have different levels of visual impairments. One is blind, others have what's known as tunnel vision, and some have just peripheral vision. However, none of those things kept them from keeping a brisk pace on the way to the summit.
We're getting rocky here. We're going to move over to our left.
Tatiana Steve is an adult volunteer with the foundation. She's walking with 13-year-old Andrew Graham, acting as his guide. Graham is completely blind. He's navigating the trail by holding onto a strap on Steve's backpack and listening to her describe the terrain ahead.
Up one and then two.
Once the kids reach the summit, they stop to fuel up on water and a few snacks. 12-year-old Roman Robago reflects on his experience with the group, who have been meeting regularly since January.
I like to come to, like, just meet new people that come here and to have fun with my friends.
For Andrew Graham, he says he's found a sense of community through the experience.
Just the fact of getting up, getting ready, and going.
It's been absolutely amazing to see the transformation of nearly almost every one of these kids.
Alexander Pushman is the director of marketing at FBC. He says the trip to the Grand Canyon this June is the 5th major excursion the foundation has organized.
The whole goal is to get these kids out and have them set a goal and obtain that goal. Something like this, an adventure like this, it's kind of one of those things where we're pushing the barrier of what they might think they're capable of.
This mentality can help give people the feeling that they have control over their destiny. That's according to Joe Streche with the American Foundation for the Blind.
For these youth who are getting this opportunity, hopefully they're building up their self-esteem, but also how to talk about themselves, how to talk about themselves confidently.
Back at North Mountain, the hikers are rounding off the last corner of the trail, and spirits are just as high as when they started.
We're going to stay awesome and be awesome.
The group has one more practice hike before heading to the Grand Canyon next month. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Coming up, a West Valley theater is trying to help kids with developmental disabilities enjoy seeing a musical.
The lights will stay at a comfortable level so young people can get up and wander and pace and do whatever they need to do to be comfortable in the environment.
a sensory-friendly performance of A Year with Frog and Toad. It's the show.
Looks like we should see a sunny holiday weekend across the valley. Look for a high today of 83, partly to mostly sunny tomorrow and Sunday, with highs of 84 tomorrow, up to 89 on Sunday. We'll crack 90 on Monday, Memorial Day, with a high of 93 degrees. Right now, it is mostly sunny and 80 at KJZZ. Quickly in traffic, 202 eastbound, the Red Mountain Freeway. There's an accident blocking the right lanes at Alma School, and on I-17 northbound, a disabled vehicle at Happy Valley.
KJZZ is supported by Live Nation, presenting the Gypsy Kings, featuring Nicholas Reyes and Tonino Baliardo, who blend traditional flamenco styles with Western pop and Latin rhythms, June 2nd at Comerica Theater. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Nearly 300 emails from the private account of Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton are open to the public, although the FBI has determined some of the once-classified material during Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State should be kept secret after all. NPR's David Wellner reports the documents all have one common subject: the U.S. diplomatic facilities that were attacked in Benghazi in 2012.
The batch of 296 emails released today is about a third of all the Benghazi-related correspondence from the private email account that Hillary Clinton used while Secretary of State. Many are from Sidney Blumenthal, a former Clinton White House aide with business dealings in Libya. Most are news articles forwarded by colleagues. Parts of some emails have been blanked out by the State Department, despite Clinton having asserted she did not use her private account for classified information. All the Benghazi-related emails were given to the Special House Committee on Benghazi in February. They're part of a larger group of 55,000 emails the State Department says will be released on a rolling basis. David Wellner, NPR News, Washington.
A National Security Agency program for bulk collection of domestic phone records is on the ropes as the Senate struggles to reach agreement on how to conduct surveillance programs aimed at spies and terrorists. At the White House, spokesman Josh Earnest said that Congress has a fundamental responsibility
to pass a piece of legislation that is critically important to ensuring that the basic safety and security of the American people is protected and that the basic civil liberties of the American people are protected.
The USA Freedom Act, which, among other things, authorizes case-by-case record searches, has already been approved in the House. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 53 points. The NASDAQ was off one. This is NPR News in Washington.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In KJZZ News at 2:36, Governor Doug Ducey today announced the start of the Classroom's First Initiative Council. He'll co-chair the council along with Jim Swanson, president and CEO of Kitchell Corporation. Members of the council include State Schools Chief Diane Douglas, Jana Day, president of the State Board for Charter Schools, and Greg Miller, president of the State Board of Education. In a statement, Ducey says the goal is to, quote, create a funding formula that incentivizes student success, not seat time. The council's first meeting will be next month and is scheduled to present preliminary recommendations in September.
With graduation season well underway, the state's largest utility is warning that something that may seem harmless could be potentially dangerous. KJZZ's Dennis Lambert explains.
Arizona Public Service wants to make sure people keep celebratory Mylar balloons, which are made out of a metallic material, in check. Spokeswoman Jenna Shaver says the shiny balloons used to celebrate special occasions represent a danger to power lines.
They actually do cause damage to our system, and it's a public safety issue as well. It can be dangerous, it can spark, it can cause a fire. We want to make sure our customers stay safe and keep these balloons away from any electrical equipment.
Shaver notes there were 50 confirmed cases last year in which balloons caused outages on the APS system, interrupting service to more than 40,000 customers. The utility recommends the balloons be tethered or kept indoors and that they be deflated when they're no longer in use. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
The NHL Stanley Cup playoffs are down to the final four teams. The Arizona Coyotes are obviously not one of them. But the Coyotes have been active in the Valley even after the team finished its season on the ice. The team says it's held almost 200 street hockey clinics at schools across the state since 2013. Matt Schott is the Coyotes' manager of amateur hockey development.
When we do those schools, we see anywhere from, I'd say, 250 to 500 kids a day. We just went last week to our last school, and that would have been our 91st visit since September of 2014. So, I mean, when we go there, we stay for the entire day. We see as many kids as we can.
Was the decision made to go with street hockey as opposed to ice hockey just because we live in Arizona and there just aren't that many ice hockey rinks at which students could learn how to do this?
So that was kind of my goal when I first started. I had a list of three things that I wanted to change. And I grew up in Arizona. I was born and raised here. I've played hockey since I was 5 years old. I've been a part of every ice rink. So I've seen, and you know, a lot of friends of mine know me as the person, like, if I want to do something as a kid, I wanted to play hockey. So I'd always try to get my friends to play hockey. And I realized as a kid, it's hard to get people to learn how to ice skate and then play hockey. So it wasn't just like my idea. They had been doing this street clinic program before I got around. It was just not as many. So my mindset is our biggest disadvantage of ice hockey is you have to learn a second dynamic. Football, baseball, basketball, golf, tennis, all those, you learn how to walk or run when you're a year and a half old. Hockey, you have to learn how to skate in order to play. If you don't know how to skate, you can't play. So I felt that street hockey gives every kid that ability. They don't have to learn that extra dynamic. They can learn how to play hockey. They can learn to love hockey. And then once they learn to love the sport, then they can take it to the next level and play ice hockey.
Do you think that your job is harder to do than that of your counterparts in places like Chicago or Toronto or Montreal?
Hard in different ways, easier in others. The hardest part for a lot of them, the East Coast teams, where they have tons of rinks and they have tons of hockey organizations and stuff, is they don't have the ability to work with everybody and work with every rink and association to help the development programs. Now, actually getting kids exposed to it, I would say they have much more, again, having the ability to have those rinks, having the weather, it is a little easier for them. But that's why we are trying to bring more street hockey to them, because I don't know. I mean, it's a handful of people that I talk to, and I, you know, you assume if a handful of people are telling you, then a handful of people are telling other people and other people and other people. So there are a number of people that do it, but I've had a handful of people come to me and say, you know, I just want to get my kid in a different sport. How does one get into hockey? Something, again, as a child that I would constantly tell my friends is, why not come to play hockey in the summer? You know, you're in an ice rink in the summer in Arizona. That's the best place to be in Arizona. It is a little easier in some senses for the other teams because they have that appeal, mainly because of the weather and the accessibility of it. And also the rich history of most teams in the Eastern Conference. It's going to take some time for us to bring hockey around, but we're definitely making huge strides with the street hockey and whatnot.
Is the ultimate goal to get more people to become fans of hockey and more specifically fans of the Coyotes and go to games and buy merchandise and cheer on the team and all?
I think strategically it is easier to market to people who already play our sport, but we want to teach people hockey. It's not like we just want the hockey people. We want the hockey people to help us, but we do want to teach people hockey.
Matt Schott is manager of amateur hockey development for the Arizona Coyotes. Matt, thank you so much.
No, no problem.
So is the Coyotes' approach to teaching people hockey an effective one? For answers, we turn to Joe Castor, president of the Valley-based sports Castor Marketing.
All of the sports teams in the Valley do youth-related programs, and I think the Coyotes are following suit. Do they need to work harder? Yeah, maybe so, because they're perhaps considered the fourth sport in Phoenix. But I personally, my family's a hockey family, and we love watching the Coyotes.
What's in it for the teams to be doing these kinds of programs?
Well, it's all about growing the sport. And with hockey, you know, you have some options from not only being, you know, street hockey, but also, of course, ultimately, they would love to see more youth get involved with ice hockey. So that's, I think, the primary reason. You get people involved at a younger age in the sport, and they're more likely to get involved somewhere down the line as a ticket holder or a fan or buying merchandise. And it's a grassroots approach.
Is this an effective way for teams to sort of grow their fan bases?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's really an important way, too. To be involved in the community is an important part of all the sports teams, and the Coyotes in particular. This is one way that they can take the sport to the fans, whether it's in Phoenix or Mesa or Tempe or throughout the entire state, hence the change from the Phoenix Coyotes to the Arizona Coyotes.
Do you think that, in general, the Coyotes are at sort of a disadvantage when compared to Canadian teams or some of the East Coast, maybe the original six NHL teams, who sort of have that built-in understanding of hockey and sort of a built-in generational fan base? The Coyotes, in many ways, don't have that. So I'm wondering if you think they're sort of at a disadvantage as far as trying to build their fan base and get more young people involved in the sport?
You know what? I think they probably need to work harder at it, and they do. But as you know, there are a lot of people in this area, in the Phoenix metro area and throughout the state, that are from places where hockey is a hotbed. And when there are many Canadians that live in the Valley of the Sun, so that love hockey and might be considered their number one sport. So I think from that perspective, they may even have a little advantage because there's so many people that live here from some place else that is more of a hockey town.
As a team that's not from here originally, that moved here from somewhere else, is it almost more important to build a fan base from younger people? Because you referenced that there are a lot of people who are here from somewhere else who maybe like hockey, but they're probably already fans of another team. In order to get Coyotes fans, does this team actually almost have to start from the ground up with younger people?
I think no question. I think the grassroots part of building your fan base is extremely important, and that grassroots effort begins with the youth. And being a team that has moved here from a different market, it might put even more emphasis on that. Yes, I think that's a fair statement.
Joe Caster is president of Sportscaster Marketing. Joe, thanks.
My pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
In the 1920s, the U.S. Forest Service began to inventory wild places across the country. As a result, 76 primitive areas were established nationwide on U.S. forest land. That designation remains for the Blue Range primitive area in eastern Arizona. But the Blue is the last primitive area in the country. Other similar territories have been redesignated as wilderness areas. Don Hoffman is a resident of the Blue Range primitive area and the former executive director of the Arizona Wilderness Coalition. He says changing the designation could help protect the pristine, untouched quality of the area.
The Forest Service actually was required to study the primitive area and make a recommendation to Congress as to whether the Blue Range should become wilderness, which happened. The Forest Service and the President made a recommendation to Congress for the Blue Range to become wilderness. But still, prospecting would be allowed in primitive areas because Congress has yet to act in regard to the Blue Range primitive area. Road building is not allowed in wilderness. Road building is not allowed in primitive areas. That was the regulations that were in place in 1964. And so many of the protections that apply to wilderness also apply to the primitive area. Prospecting is sort of an exception. And when I say prospecting and prospectors, it's not just, I'm sure you're aware, not old-time prospectors with
their pickaxe and their raggedy beards. Yeah.
With burros carrying their load, but in fact it's like Phelps Dodge and mining companies can still do that. Now, when the Forest Service went through that process, one of the things they did was do an analysis of what the mineral potential was based on the technology of the late 60s, early 70s. And the indication was that there was very little economic value for mineral exploration in the Blue Range, and that certainly entered into the decision of the Forest Service and the President's recommendation.
I had a couple questions for you that were more of the philosophical bent, if you don't mind, just because your experience is so interesting to me. What's the value to us as a society of having so-called wild spaces, to our culture, to our society?
There are several, and they're actually fairly well described in the Wilderness Act. But there's certainly places where an individual can go and seek solitude to basically provide them with whatever solitude will provide them, whether it's spiritual enrichment or just a fantastic recreational experience that is something that's important to them. Primitive forms of recreation is another one, that a place where somebody can go and be in an environment that's mostly natural appearing, generally unaffected by the works of man, and it's a different experience than car camping, for instance. There's also scientific and ecological benefits that come with wilderness areas as well.
Well, I was going to ask you to talk specifically about Blue Range. What does it feel like to visit and to live in such a pristine place where humans don't always go, whether because it's just not part of their everyday ritual or whatnot? Can you describe for us a little bit, if you don't mind getting personal, what it really feels like?
A lot of times during my career working for the Forest Service, I'd go out for maybe for 10 to 14 days at a time into the backcountry. And I will say, like, maybe even like the first two, three, four nights out, there'd be sort of like this feeling like you were in a really unique environment, and you didn't necessarily really feel like you were a part of that environment. But after 10 days, walking back to camp, traveling to your next camp, there was a feeling that you truly belonged in a wild place. That you were truly living out there in a wild place, and your senses changed. There was a number of things that would change where you just felt like a comfort level of being part of that environment that you didn't really feel like, you know, one night out away from home. But after several days, it was quite significant.
Don Hoffman is a resident of the Blue Range Primitive Area and the former executive director of the Arizona Wilderness Coalition. You can read more about the story in the June issue of Arizona Highways magazine.
Good afternoon, happy Friday. It's the show on KJZZ. He's Steve, I'm Mark. The show is bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Checking traffic on this Friday afternoon, some heavy slowing already on the 202 westbound from 44th Street into about the I-10. The forecast for this holiday weekend, look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 83 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight with a low in the mid-60s. Partly to mostly sunny tomorrow and Sunday with highs of 84 tomorrow, 89 on Sunday. We'll hit 93 for Memorial Day on Monday. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 80 degrees at KJZZ at 250.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering a selection of USDA Prime New York Strip Steaks, all-natural chicken breast, and pork baby back ribs for Memorial Day barbecues. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
There is a frog,
there's a toad,
and he lives just down the road.
At a recent rehearsal for Theater Works in Peoria's production of the musical A Year with Frog and Toad, their performers welcomed some visitors who wouldn't normally be attending the show. It was part of a special Greet Your Seat event when people, especially kids with developmental disabilities, could take a look around and get comfortable with the theater. Theater Works is trying something new on Saturday for A Year with Frog and Toad, a sensory-friendly performance. Michelle Berry says her daughter Sunny is autistic and has struggled with attending previous shows that weren't tailored to attendees with her condition.
When the music swelled or when the sound got loud, she would just cover her ears or, you know, like kind of, they call it shutting down, put her head down and not interact anymore. So hopefully this one will be better for her.
So what's different about the sensory-friendly performance of A Year with Frog and Toad? Chris Hamby is Director of Education and Outreach for Theater Works.
To adjust sound and light levels, we have a storm sequence where there are normally lots of pulsing lights and strobes, and those things have all been tamed down, that the sound levels of that storm have been tamed down. Some of the more loud and frightening elements have been toned down. Probably one of the most important things is that this show, the house lights will not go out of all the way down, that the lights will stay at a comfortable level so young people can get up and wander and pace and do whatever they need to do to be comfortable in the environment.
Hamby says he's also received tips on beginning the actual production in a less than typical way.
You can't just get up, do a curtain speech, and start the show. that you really need to pace that transition into the show. And so to give a very clear time that in 5 minutes the show is going to start. And then that is when the sequence of transitioning into the performance begins. That's when the lights start to change and doors start to close very systematically, as opposed to lights out and here we go in a normal production.
Why did you think it was important to have this kind of performance?
In my work at TheaterWorks, we do a lot with adaptive students. Two of the big programs that we work with are One Step Beyond, which deals with cognitive disabilities in the West Valley. Also, the city of Peoria has an adaptive program that we work with. And so I've really noticed that a lot of people shy away from going to the theater because it sometimes can seem like a very serious outing that you need to be very proper and you need to be quiet and you don't want to disturb other people in the audience. And so this is a time where all of those behaviors are okay, that if you need to get up and walk around, if you need to talk, if you need to communicate through a device such as a tablet or a cell phone, all of that will be okay, that everyone in the audience knows that, the cast knows that, the staff working the event all know that.
I hope for my daughter to feel at ease and not have that anxiety at the end of the performance.
Veronica Ragland is project leader for Treasure House, a living community for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. She's also the mom of a 10-year-old autistic daughter. Ragland will be watching closely to see how her daughter reacts once the performance is done.
Where not only is she clapping, but she's also confident in terms of, you know, walking out and not feeling, you know, not feeling the anxiety that normally she does, where we pretty much wait for a theater to clear out before she comes out. I would love for her to, you know, have the opportunity to stay and meet and greet some of the actors afterwards. A lot of times she'll shy away from that, and I think it's because she's just been a little bit startled by the performance.
Chris Hamby of TheaterWorks says A Year with Frog and Toad has some inherent pluses that make it a good fit for an adapted production.
The designers really were guided to use a lot of vivid colors, a lot of vivid imagery on the stage to give it a really rich feel. And it's just fun. It is probably the funnest show that I've ever worked on. The music is fun. And I know we say a lot in the theater that it's a show for everyone, but this really is. This is a show that, you know, a 3-year-old can attend and an 80-year-old can attend, and they're all going to enjoy it. So it really was the perfect piece of theater to be able to turn into a sensory-friendly performance.
And Veronica Ragland hopes the special sensory performance will be the first of many such productions and can act as a bridge between a so-called typical theater-goer and one with developmental disabilities.
It helps to show that people are more alike than different. And that, you know, even in the production sense, for something like enjoying the show, shows like this that are intentionally trying to be inclusive are absolutely going to have to help to connect diverse populations like people with disabilities and serve as the bridge and help us understand that we all laugh the same. We, you know, sometimes there's humor that my kids get that I don't get. You know, but that doesn't necessarily take away from the production, and we all can enjoy it.
The sensory-friendly performance of A Year with Frog and Toad at TheaterWorks in Peoria is tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock.
It was the first of its kind in Arizona. It was installed in a booming town early in the last century, and it's still in use today. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez goes for a ride.
The Jerome Grant Hotel is one of the oldest buildings in the central Arizona town. It was built in the 1920s, and among the many unique parts of this place is the elevator. Did you know this Otis elevator was the first of its kind in Arizona?
It was brand new, state-of-the-art, you know, deal back then.
Chris Altier is manager of the Jerome Grant Hotel.
Yeah, it was a self-service that didn't require an operator to go up or down with you. People come up to Jerome from all parts of the globe to see this building and to ride that Otis elevator. So we're going up to the the third floor.
This self-service elevator was installed around 1926, when this was originally the United Verde Hospital. It was built by the local mining company when Jerome was a booming mining town. There were about 15,000 people that lived here. The five-floor concrete hospital was built to withstand mining blasts. It was the last major structure built high on the Cleopatra Hill.
They wrote a blank check for this hospital. They said, we don't care what it costs. They were making that sort of money in these mines.
The ground floor lobby was actually the hospital emergency entrance. The elevator was the way patients were taken to any of the 52 hospital beds on the upper floors. It served Jerome residents until the mid-1950s. Mining in the town dwindled. People moved to other mining areas, and the hospital closed. It remained closed and empty for more than four decades until Altier's uncle and father bought the property.
Yeah, they knew that they were getting a piece of history. We didn't know if everything would be able to be brought back up and work. We're luckily able to get it going. And it's been serving us for 20 years, and that thing, it never gives us any problems. You know, that elevator just runs like a champ.
If you're wondering if you can hop on the elevator and ride it, well, hotel guests are given elevator keys when they check in to take it to their room on the upper floors. And by the way, Jerome is known for being a ghost town. Well, this elevator has its own ghost story. It's believed that an elevator maintenance man mysteriously died under it while working on it. Today, guests are encouraged to record their mysterious encounters or experiences in books left on the lobby counter. And there are many entries in the books sitting there. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix or the Valley unique, or just hear some spooky things you want to tell us about, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
And the long Memorial Day weekend kicks off this way, tonight at 8 p.m. at Harrah's Auction Casino in Maricopa, a teen idol of the 70s, Leif Garrett.
Was he an idol of yours?
He was not. I did not read Tiger Beat, but thanks for asking.
You have to ask the tough questions. The D-backs will be hosting the Chicago Cubs this weekend at Chase Field in downtown Phoenix.
Soul Power brings funk Friday and Sunday nights at 9 to Char's Has the Blues in Phoenix.
Also, the John Spencer Blues Explosion will be performing tonight at Crescent Ballroom in Phoenix.
And, of course, you might be out barbecuing this weekend. Just enjoy yourself. Try not to drive too much. Unless you're actually driving somewhere like, I don't know, California, to enjoy yourself or other families or something like that.
Lots of places to drive around here. Absolutely. Or just driving up to the Grand Canyon for the weekend. That's fine,
or drive
too.
Yourself crazy, which we try to do.
Right. The show is produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer, John Hoban.
We want to hear from you, so let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas or story ideas you're not even sure about. We can probably make something out of it. theshow@kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. Have a great long weekend. It's 3 o'clock.